Daniel chapter 3, beginning to read from verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, the prefects, the governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps and the prefects and the governors and advisors and treasurers and judges and magistrates and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "This is what you are commanded to do, O peoples, nations, and men of every language. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship immediately will be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You have issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, O king. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipes, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Well, then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. He ordered the furnace to be heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. And so these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. And the king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Today we're looking at the story of three men who were prepared to die for their belief in God. In other words, we're looking at the story of three young fools. Isn't that right? Isn't that what we think? See, in our culture, belief in God is reckoned to be a bit like belief in fairies. You meet people who seem to be perfectly rational in every other way, but somehow they are open to the idea that there might be little men down the bottom of the garden or a big man in the sky, whatever, same difference. So you humor them. You know, if it comforts them in some way, well, I suppose it's sort of harmless, you know, as long as they keep it to themselves. But to be prepared to die for this invisible being, this is not just foolish, this is dangerous. These are the sort of fanatics who think that in public life, rational debate should be trumped by their irrational beliefs. There's a film that's just come out called Agora. It's a warning against these sort of dangerous people. It's set in 4th century Alexandria, and it claims, although there is actually no evidence for this claim, that it was the Christians who destroyed the great library in Alexandria. So library, great repository of culture and learning, and Christian fanatics destroy it. And that just goes to show, these people, they are dangerous. They are a threat to civilization. They are foolish, and they are dangerous. Is that what these three young men are? Let's look at how the events of Daniel 3 are told. Three scenes. Scene 1, the king who defied the Lord. This is verses 1 to 13. The king who defied the Lord. The story so far is that the Babylonians have trashed Jerusalem, and they have dragged the cream of God's people into exile in Babylon. And the idea was that after 3 years of training, gifted young men like Daniel would lose all their Jewish ideas about their Jewish God, and they would become thoroughly soaked in the culture and the values of Babylon. And then they would enter into the service of the king. And for the Jews, this was utterly bewildering. How could their God, the Lord, allow such a thing? Is it because he doesn't care? Has he just given up on protecting his people? Is he forgotten his promises? Or is it because he's not in control? Is it that there was nothing he could do about this? He was helpless. His hands were tied. And of course, we 21st century types, we're thinking, or is it because he's not real? You know, like fairies at the bottom of the garden. God is just a fantasy, isn't he? He's just a fantasy born of our longing for something a little magical in our lives. God talk. It's just a way of projecting our hopes and our hang-ups onto a kind of big religious screen. And then the Jews had their ideas and the Babylonians had theirs and we have ours. And for some people that kind of works. But the idea that there really is a God in control of things, that's a delusion, isn't it? Well, chapter 1 insists that it was the Lord who delivered Jerusalem into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. Chapter 1 insists events are not spinning out of control. The Lord knows the end from the beginning. And this is what the Lord had warned them about for years. And what's happening is exactly in line with his word, what he said. And then in chapter 2, in Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream and he wants to know what his dream means. And so that he can be sure that his court magicians aren't just sort of spinning him a line, he asks them first to tell him what the dream was. And of course, nobody can, except for Daniel. the Lord reveals the dream to Daniel. Daniel interprets it. And the message of the dream is summed up. Just flick back a page. The message of the dream is summed up in chapter 2, verse 20. Daniel says, chapter 2, verse 20, "Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and opposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning." See, the message of the dream is that the Lord, the God of the Jews, is not just another idea of God among many ideas. He's real. For the Jews didn't create him, he created the world. And he is not shaped by history, he shapes history. You see, he sets up kings, he deposes them. So the message of the dream was, Nebuchadnezzar, you may think that with all your power, the events of history are all in your hands. But Nebuchadnezzar, you need to know that it is the Lord who sets up kings and prime ministers, incidentally. And it is the Lord who deposes them. In other words, this world and all its events are not in your hands, Nebuchadnezzar. They are in his hands. And so in the dream, there was this statue. There was a head of gold, chest of silver, thighs of bronze, leg of iron, feet of clay. And the statue stands tall for a while, but then it's smashed. And Daniel says, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. You have been given authority for a time, but it's not ultimate authority. It's authority the Lord has given you for a time. And just as he raised you up, he will bring you down again and raise up other kingdoms after you, silver, bronze, and iron. But in the end, all human kingdoms will come tumbling down, and all that will be left will be the kingdom of God. And that is because the Lord is the ultimate king. King over this whole world. God over all of history. All of mystery. All nations. All cities. All people. And that is what King Nebuchadnezzar comes to see. After Daniel tells him his dream, Nebuchadnezzar says, chapter 2, verse 47, back over the page, "The king said to Daniel," chapter 2, verse 47, "surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." But then, chapter 3, verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. It's a big statue. In kind of new money, it's about, 3 meters wide, about 30 meters high. It is a big statue. And Nebuchadnezzar has set it up in direct defiance of the dream in chapter 2. See, in the dream, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom was represented by a head of gold. Do you remember? And so he sets up this statue all of gold. He's saying, my kingdom's not just the head. It's the whole body. My kingdom will not be supplanted. It will stand forever. What about chapter 2, verse 47? "Surely your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings." The evidence had been compelling. Daniel had been able to reveal Nebuchadnezzar's dream to him. It was clear that the Lord is the God of gods, the King of kings. That is reality. But you see what's happened? Nebuchadnezzar doesn't want to face up to that reality. He doesn't want to have to surrender his life to the Lord. In his life, he likes being king. And through Nebuchadnezzar, we get a glimpse into the human heart. If you want to see it in all its fullness, look at the way the people in power and authority treated Jesus. People often ask, they often say, where is the evidence? Where is the evidence that your God is Lord over all? I've not had anyone come up and tell me my dreams. Where's the evidence? And the Bible says the place to look is in the person of Jesus Christ. And the book of Daniel is all about the promise that the Lord will show the world that he is king. And the Bible says that promise is fulfilled in Jesus. Jesus is God come to show the world he is king. And so there is Jesus, healing the sick and calming storms and raising the dead, demonstrating that he has power and authority that nobody else has. He's God's king over all kings, king over the world. But they don't want to have to surrender to him. So they nail him to a cross. And the Bible says it's not just them. So many people I speak to who scoff at belief in God. You know, it's like believing in fairies down the end of the garden. They say, well, there's no evidence. And it turns out they've never got round to looking at the person of Jesus. The one place worth looking in. And we don't want to look too carefully there, because what if he does turn out to be the King of Kings and we have to surrender our lives to him? So people don't even look. The famous atheist writer, very perceptive guy actually, Aldous Huxley, he was very honest. He wrote, he said, I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning. And he goes on to say his motives were that he didn't want there to be a God who, as he saw it, would interfere with my sexual freedom. See, he didn't want to have to surrender. It's very striking, this, because we again and again, we think the problem is lack of evidence. Look at Nebuchadnezzar. The problem is we don't want to surrender. In our lives, we want to be king. And Nebuchadnezzar wants to be king over all nations. So he sets up this statue of gold. Verse 2, he then summoned the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the advisors and the treasurers and the judges and the magistrates and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the advisors and the treasurers and the judges and all the rest of them show up. Massive state occasion. Armies marching, horses, chariots, all kicking up dust as they gather on the plain of Dura, north of Babylon, outside the city. You can imagine grandstands being especially built for the occasion. Row upon row of dignitary in uniform, wearing all their medals. People from all the nations that Nebuchadnezzar has conquered, lined up, gathered around this statue. Verse 4, then the herald loudly proclaimed, this is what you're commanded to do, O peoples, nations, men of every language. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn and all the rest of the music, fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. In the 1930s, between the 1930s and the 1950s, all over Eastern Europe, statues of Stalin sort of sprung up in town squares. And the idea was you walk past it on your way to work, and this huge monument towered over you and said, the state is ultimate. The state is God. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. It's pretty shrewd. It's a shrewd way to unite the nations he has subdued. He's saying, all of you people with all your different cultures and your different gods, when the music strikes, when it strikes up, you know, to give it a kind of religious, ritual, festival feel, when the music strikes up, I want you all to bow down to worship and recognize my kingdom is ultimate. My kingdom is God. And just to underline how ultimate my kingdom is, verse 6, whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. Your life and your death are in my hands. I'm ultimate. Just think how hard it would have been to be a worshipper of the Lord in a situation like that. In the teeth of all the kind of military might and all the state machinery of Babylon, the noise, the spectacle, the power of it all right there in front of you, and you were trying to serve some invisible God? Think how hard it is for our brothers and sisters in Iran. Just reading the other day, church services are monitored by the secret police. Christians finding it harder and harder to get jobs in Iran or at North Korea. It is illegal to possess a Bible in North Korea. They reckon at the moment there are between about 50 and 70,000 Christians in political prison camps. Wouldn't there be a massive temptation to think, am I just being a fool? You know, I'm confronted by the power of the state and I hold on to my invisible God. I guess there's a similar kind of temptation for us. Perhaps you're the only Christian in your family, or the only Christian in your office, or the only Christian on your team. And And they are just getting on with life. And the life you can see and touch. And you think, well, I am holding on to this invisible God. And is it worth it? Am I sure I don't just believe in fairies? What's the story's verdict? What's the story's verdict on Nebuchadnezzar? Well, the way the story is told underlines his power and his might. The satraps and the prefects and the governors and the advisors and the treasurers and the judges and the magistrates. But on the other hand, did you catch how the story makes fun of him? See, once through, and the list sounds kind of impressive, keep repeating it and you get the giggles. The satraps and the prefects and the judges and the magistrates, it all sounds so pompous. All these people in their uniforms with their medals on their chests, and up strikes the band, the horn, the flute, and all the rest of it, and all these great dignitaries to a man bow down to this, what? Lump of gold. See, we're made to feel fools because we worship a god. But here is the point. Everyone has a god they worship. We all bow down and make something in our lives ultimate. It may not be a gold statue, may not be the state, but what is it? The thing you're living for, the thing you'll do anything for, the thing you will make any sacrifice for. Put it like this, what is the thing that if you lost it, your whole world would fall apart? You got it? That's your God. That's the God you worship. Is it a good God to worship? For some, it's their sport, isn't it? They get injured and they can't play and they don't know who to be anymore. For others, it's careers. They do anything to get to the top, make any sacrifice. For some, it's their reputations. They're constantly alive to what everyone thinks of them. Holidays. People live for their holidays. Families. These are our gods. We bow before them and we say, will you be my salvation? I think that's why a holiday ruined by rain is so devastating. Because you're looking to that holiday to deliver you salvation. Deliver me fun and refreshment and justify the long hours I work. And then when it rains, it doesn't deliver. That's why we get so angry at our children. It's not just they have behaved badly. It's they have not fulfilled our hopes for them. See, we were looking to them to be our salvation, to be all the things we could never be. And they've not delivered. So we get so crushed when they go in a direction we don't want them to go. We all have gods we bow before. And here they are bowing before this lump of gold. You see, to hear how it's repeated that it's one that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. He set it up, the image Nebuchadnezzar has set up. So it's extraordinary. The court of Babylon in chapter 2 has just encountered the living Lord, the God who knows what a man is dreaming because he made us, because he knows us better than we know ourselves. And rather than bowing down to worship the living God, they all bow down to worship this lump of metal that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. In this story, who are the fools? The ones who worship the God who made them, or the ones who worship the God they made? See, it's not that we don't want gods. It's that we don't want the God. We don't want a God who calls us to surrender. What we want is we want a God who will indulge our desires. And we all know from painful experience at Christmas, overindulgence just makes us sick. And you see something of the sickness in verse 8 onwards. At this time, some astrologers came forward and they denounced the Jews and they said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You have issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, and all the rest of it should be thrown in the blazing furnace if they don't bow down and worship you." And look at verse 13. News that these people do not serve, do not worship the image of gold Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Nebuchadnezzar is, verse 13, furious with rage. See, if a state thinks it is ultimate, If all it does is indulge its desire for power, it is a dangerous place to live. See, it's not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who are dangerous here in this episode. It is Nebuchadnezzar. Because anyone who challenges him will be wiped out. But it's not just Babylon or North Korea. Any culture that worships the gods that we make for ourselves, the gods that indulge our desires, is a very dangerous place to live. Because here is the thing, what if my desire collides with your desire? What if we both want the same piece of land? Who gets to have the land? If we both want the same job, who gets the job? If we both want to be thought as being at the center of the in crowd, which one of us gets to be at the center of the in crowd? Shall we fight for it? So these small gods whom we worship, they pit us against one another in a kind of perpetual power play, each of us wanting our way. I mean, you even see it in the way parenting has become so competitive. Everyone is so alive to whose child is walking when, who's talking first. You know, as though it matters, as though in later life people look at you and go, oh, but you were an early walker. The point is, in a culture like this, where we worship small gods, it is always a dangerous place to live. It's always a place where people get hurt. Especially dangerous for those who do not serve those small gods. Because everyone else is serving these small gods, and people will get, as Nebuchadnezzar was, furious with rage at those who are serving the God. Because they don't want to be reminded of the reality of the king. They don't want to be called to surrender to him. So they reject the king. It's no surprise they reject those who follow the king. As Peter says in his letter, do not be surprised at the painful trials you are suffering, as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ. Scene one, king who defied the Lord. Scene two, the men who serve the Lord. This is verses 14 to 18. The choice set before them is this, bow or burn. Well, how would I have reacted? I guess I would have rationalized it. Okay, here's what we do, guys. Quick bow, get it over with. We'll go along with him now so that later we will be promoted to positions of influence and then we can make a difference. See, if we burn now, we can't really be used by God in the future. So quick bow, get it done with. I think that's what I would have said. I think that's what we tell ourselves. Keep quiet now, and then when I have won their respect, then speak up. What they say is remarkable, isn't it? Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. It's not your verdict on our lives that matters. You are not ultimate. But that's what Nebuchadnezzar had claimed. Remember back in verse 15? Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? You see? What God can rescue you from my hand? My hand is the biggest hand there is. He's claiming to be ultimate. He's saying the destiny of these men is in his hand. And their answer is verse 17. Now, if we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it. And he will rescue us from your hand, O king. See, you are not ultimate. Our God is ultimate. Our destiny is not in your hand, Nebuchadnezzar. Our destiny is in his. And we say, what is this? Is this blind belief? Is this fairies at the bottom of the garden again? No, it's a confidence in their God based on what he has shown them of himself. They knew the history of Israel. They knew how their God had rescued them from Egypt. They knew how their God had said they would end up in Babylon. They'd seen his hand over history. They'd heard the episode when the Lord had revealed the dream to Daniel. Their God has shown them who he is. And they say, Nebuchadnezzar, you are not ultimate. He is. But verse 18 is even more remarkable. But even if he does not rescue us, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Really took my breath away reading that. See, we live in a culture that thinks people worship God because it kind of works for them. In other words, it's just another way of indulging our desires. See, we just want a religious experience that will help us to feel good about ourselves and give us a rich and happy life. Well, if Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego worshipped the Lord because it just kind of worked for them, this would be a good moment to stop worshipping him, don't you think? Because this is not working for them. They are about to be toast. But what they are saying is, we don't worship our God because it just kind of works for us. We worship him because he is real. So whatever happens, we will never worship that statue. Because that statue is not God. And whatever happens, we will never stop worshiping our God because he is God. And to stop worshiping him just for a comfortable life would be to deny reality. And friends, we know more than they did. We've seen him keep all his promises. We've seen him work out his purposes in history. The plan that climaxed with the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. And we look at Jesus and we see who our God is. And the resurrection says that our God is bigger than death. In this universe, he is ultimate. We're not worshipping the Lord because it just kind of works for us. We're that kind of type of people. We're religious people. We worship him because he's real. And the danger is when life is sunshine and lollipops, we sing his praises. What a great God we have. And then when it costs us to serve him, we think, this isn't what we had in mind. Oh, I'm not going to go on worshipping this God if it means I lose my job. Hold on, why was I worshipping him in the first place? He's not just some kind of way of indulging my desires. You see, in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we see we serve the Lord because he really is God. So what else can we do? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are saying, our God is real like a mountain. And someone may say, well, it's very inconvenient and very costly to have to walk around this mountain. Why don't you just walk through the mountain? To which the answer is, we can't. It's a mountain. It's not just an idea. It's how things really are. See, we think, well, yeah, because if they die, they'll lose their chance to be an influence, won't they? No, it's by being prepared to die that they are saying loud and clear to the court of Babylon, our God is not a funny little belief in fairies that we entertain because it makes us feel better about ourselves. Our God is reality, reality that shapes our whole universe. Ask us to deny him, it'd be like asking us to walk through the mountain. It can't be done. So scene two, the men who serve the Lord. Final scene, the Lord who saves his people. This is 19 to 30. Friends, when it costs us to worship the Lord, as it does, we need to remind ourselves again and again that the Lord has never promised a comfortable life. What he's promised us is that he will save us. Look at Nebuchadnezzar, so furious at their attitude that he heats the furnace to seven times hotter than usual. It's like normal hot, normal temperature is not going to be good enough for these people. I want them fried. And Nebuchadnezzar commands, verse 20, some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. And they go in wearing their robes and their trousers and their turbans and all the rest of it. And look what happens, verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, weren't there three men we tied up and threw in the fire? And they replied, certainly, O king. It's definitely just the three. And he said, but look, I see four men walking around in the fire. Walking around in the fire, unbound, unharmed. The fourth looks like a son of the gods. There's some debate about who exactly this fourth man is. Is he a kind of pre-incarnate Jesus? Is he some kind of angel? Well, wherever we land on that particular debate, the point is clear. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego must have felt so small, so foolish, so alone in the teeth of the might of Babylon. But there, in the flames, do you see? They're not alone. They're not alone. The God whom they worship is with them. It's one of the recurring promises of the Bible. I think of Jesus at the end of Matthew's gospel. I am with you always. It's at the very end of the age. He's able to say that because he is not some small godlet. He's the king who rules over the whole world, and there is no place we can go that can put us out of his reach. Wherever we go, whatever happens to us, whomever we have to stand before, we are not alone. The God of the world is alongside us, with us in the fire. Look how it goes on. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come out. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the royal advisors crowded around them, and they saw the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, not even a smell of fire on them. It's a brilliant moment. Look at the satraps and the prefects and the governors and all the rest of the people who had bowed down to this statue. They crowd round and look on in amazement as these men emerge from the furnace. The fire had not harmed their bodies. Not one hair was singed. No smell of fire on them. What are we to make of that? It's not a promise that we will sail through life unscathed and unscarred. It can't be. In chapter 11, we read of God's people being tortured and killed. But the point is this. Nebuchadnezzar had said in verse 15, what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? You see, and as all the satraps and the prefects and the judges and the magistrates and all the rest of them look at these unsinged robes, the people who had bowed to the statue are confronted by reality. You see, there is a God who can rescue from Nebuchadnezzar's hand. The power and the might of Babylon are very impressive. They are, but they're not ultimate. There is a God who can save from death. And this passage is just one of the many Old Testament signposts along the road to the New Testament where we see the Lord's great demonstration that he is the God who can save from death. We see it in the resurrection of Jesus. Death seems to be ultimate, doesn't it? It seems to have the last word on our lives. It's the word that ruins, spoils everything. It's the tool that tyrants use to oppress people. It's what cuts down a young life and its prime. It's what separates people who love each other. It's what leaves everything unsaid, unresolved. It's what makes a mockery of a lifetime's hard work. Death. Last word. And the resurrection of Jesus, though, it is not just the promise of an afterlife. It's the demonstration that death does not have the last word on our lives. Jesus does. It's a demonstration. He is the king of this world, and he has power and authority to restore this world to how it's meant to be, to put things back together again. And one day, that is what he will do. And it'll be wonderful. See, a world in which everyone worships their own small god is a dangerous place. But a world where everyone worships the one true God is a place of harmony. So he says there'll be no more death. Every tear will be wiped dry. No more pain. He says he'll do justice. All that's wrong will be put right. All that's broken, all the people who are broken, will be put back together again. We will be the people we were created to be. Because we will have the relationship with God that we were created for. That is the salvation that the God of the Bible promises. He doesn't promise a comfortable life, but he promises he will save us. And the point is, the small gods we worship, they can't save us. They can't give us a world made new. They are helpless in the face of death. In the face of death, the career we live for, the sport we live for, the families we thought we could keep safe, they all come tumbling down, don't they? Like that statue in chapter 2. And so Daniel chapter 3 is saying, why live for gods that cannot save us when there is a God who can save us? Let's close. What is the chapter's verdict on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? It's something like this. They are not the dangerous ones. Look at verse 30. I mean, actually, Nebuchadnezzar carries on being dangerous. I mean, his final word is, anyone who doesn't obey me on this particular command, cut into pieces. He hasn't really got it yet. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they are promoted, verse 30, in the province of Babylon. You see, they are the sort of people you need in positions of responsibility. We think, yeah, but if they're religious, they will be after power. Well, if we worship lots of different small gods, then yes, we will be pitted against one another. Power play. But if we are true worshippers of the one true God, then we're not in it to indulge our desires to get our way. We're in it to serve him and go his way. So we won't be backing the party that indulges our desires, that gives us what we want that's good for us. We'll be backing the one that reflects his character, his concern for justice for all. That's the way of the true worshipper. They're not the dangerous ones. And they're not the fools. They're wise. And in the Bible, being wise is not about being clever or brilliant or brave. It's just about facing up to the truth about God. And it may seem as though all the world around us has all the power. And we may feel like fools for not joining in and worshipping the gods everyone else worships. And Daniel 3 says, look beyond the appearances. See reality. Your future's not in the hands of your boss or your bank manager. Your future's not in the hands of the guy at work who bullies you. Or the father who makes you feel very small. Your life is not held hostage by the illness that you struggle with. The sin you've been hurt by, the mistake you once made. The King of Kings has authority and power over all those things. His hand is bigger than any hand that may seek to harm you or hurt you. His are the hands that can rescue you from death itself. So brothers and sisters, being in his hands this week may feel very costly. People may turn against you. There may be a temptation to wriggle free from his hands. But if we're in the hands of the God who saves, why would we ever want to be anywhere else? Let's pray. Oh God, we praise you that you are the one who rescues, the God who saves. And we thank you that though you don't promise an easy life, you do promise to save us. And we praise you for how wonderful that is. And we praise you for how wonderful you are. Amen.
Well, as always, we now have a chance to reflect on what God's been saying to us through his word by his spirit and to brew up any questions we might have for our question time that will begin in just a few moments at a time. You might want to do that by yourself. You might want to do that in conversation with the people nearby. But whatever happens, some questions have already appeared behind me, as if by magic, to help you in your thinking and your discussion. And this hat is going to be passed around for you to put questions in. There should be little post-it notes to help you do that. If not, you might have to improvise with paper. But we'll have our question time in a few moments' time. Loads of questions this week, as always, and really only time for two, I'm afraid. So if your question hasn't been answered, which it probably won't have because we've only got time for two, do grab Mike. He'll be standing
What we're doing
the
each
front.
Week is we're collecting all the questions so they don't get lost, because a lot of the questions that people are asking, well, the themes, the issues will recur as we go through Daniel. So we kept all last week's, and we'll keep these weeks, and we'll kind of feed the questions into our preparation. What do we got today?
Are there things out there? I mean, you mentioned that there are perhaps idols out there, things like perhaps sometimes jobs and children, and that sort of thing that we bow down to. Are there any laws today in which we should be taking a sort of similar stand against, in the same way that these guys did thousands of years ago? Is it just the gods of our age in the sense of other things, or are there particular things that the state is asking us to do today that we should be saying no to?
It's a good question. I want to answer it slightly unhelpfully. I remember when I went to spent some time in the former East Germany, and I remember going there and arriving sort of wide-eyed and naive, and I said, how did you survive communism? And without missing a beat, they said back to me, how do you survive capitalism? In other words, the point is not just before we even get to the specific laws, the specific things we are required to do that may push us across a line we cannot cross, we need to be alive to the whole culture that we collude with. So in other words, if we were in communism, we'd be massively alive to what the way the culture is squeezing us and conforming us, to use Paul's language. And we tend to just think, oh, our culture is kind of neutral. And actually, there are all kinds of ways in which Christians from the developing world look at us and say, do you see how compromised these Western Christians are? So before I think of particular laws, I think I'd want to keep asking the question about the way the culture shapes us to buy things and have things and long for things, consume things. That actually some of our Christian friends from across the world find extraordinary.
If it's God that raises up kings and deposes them, what's the point of voting on Thursday?
Because God works out his purposes through human beings. I think we struggle with this. So we think, whenever we think of God being in control, the only model we can think of is like my being in control of this music stand. You know, my sort of sovereign relationship over this music stand is I can kick it over. If anything's going to happen, I've got to sort of make it happen. It's an inanimate object. God's sovereign control over human beings is not like my control over a music stand. In other words, we are human beings created for God, and we always think, oh, if he exercises sovereignty over us, we will be reduced to music stands. In the new creation, the thing is, we will be... everything will be lined up under his sovereignty wonderfully, and we'll be most free. So the Bible never pits God's sovereignty against our human responsibility to go on acting. So therefore, people who are wicked are blamed for it, and people who are virtuous are commended for it. That's the world of the Bible. But the point is, God works out his sovereignty through human agency. So we're not fatalists. We don't just go, well, it'll happen. However, God calls his people to say, be wise. Which way do you think would reflect my ways? Come and be involved in what I'm doing. So we can't just sit back and let it happen. It
needs a vote.
It needs a vote. Yes, it needs a vote.
Great. Thank you, Mike. Do you grab him with questions afterwards? I'll move across.